come on in and spend some time with the film hobbyist. My name is Lydia, and I love movies. We're sitting here in my attic room. I'm in an old desk chair. You're sitting on a forest green Walmart futon with a black metal frame. We're in a little nook here, next to the wall, a window between us looking out at my backyard. Normally this is a lovely view, but it's early spring, which means everything is pretty dull and lifeless. I'm convinced that people who say they love spring actually just love May, when it's sunny and 75 degrees and the grass is a vibrant green, the trees have leaves, and all the flowers are in bloom. Now it is damp and chilly and gray, and the trees are mostly bare. If it wasn't for my neighbor's bright red tulips, I'd be pretty miserable. But speaking of colorful tulips, this week, we're talking about last year's Wicked Part 1, directed by John M. Chu. I've been a fan of this movie since 2021, when I saw John Chu's last film, In the Heights, in theaters. I was one of maybe five people who saw that movie in theaters. It's magnificent, by the way. Thrilling and vibrant and alive. Around the time of release, John Chu was announced to be in talks to direct Wicked. And it was during 96,000, a hip-hop musical number set at a community pool with Busby Berkeley-style choreography, that I realized I needed to see his version of Wicked, particularly his version of What Is This Feeling? In the Broadway staging, that number is dynamic in the shape of its choreography. A lesser director would just have repeated the choreography on a courtyard set with a million cuts between angles. John Chu fleshes out time and setting, adding layers of story underneath each verse through his visuals. Universal smartly released that number online in its entirety the week before the film's debut. It tells you what I knew in the theater in 2021. That John Chu is a master of the film language of movie musicals. He doesn't just know how to work with a choreographer and some decent singers. He understands the camera movements and editing rhythms, the necessity of interesting sets, and an excellent ensemble. And this time, the theaters weren't empty. It's been really lovely to see this movie connecting with so many people, not just former theater kids like me and their moms, but curious dudes who wanted to understand the hype. It's had a much bigger audience than I expected. And the more I've thought about it, the more I think it has to do with this movie's relationship with the 1939 film version of The Wizard of Oz. And how it's the first movie to dare risk treating that film as if it isn't just some corporate-owned property, but as it should be, part of the public domain. So what is the public domain? It's a term connected with copyright law, but on a conceptual level, it boils down to this idea. Once a particular work has existed long enough, it no longer belongs to the creator, their estate, or the corporation that owns them, but belongs to the public to use and iterate on and to rework. In 1697, Charles Perrault published a version of the fairy tale Cinderella, one with a fairy godmother, a pumpkin carriage, and a glass slipper. The public domain understands that this story, and the glass slipper, and the fairy godmother, do not belong to Charles Perrault anymore. He's dead. His heirs are dead. This story and these elements are bigger than him, and anyone may publish and sell what he wrote, or translate his words, or iterate on the same concepts. So in 1950, Walt Disney could make an animated movie called Cinderella with a fairy godmother, a pumpkin carriage, and a glass slipper. And they can make money off of that. And Rodgers and Hammerstein in 1957 could also write a TV musical called Cinderella with a fairy godmother, a pumpkin carriage, and a glass slipper that they can profit from as well. Because those elements and that story belong to the public. Even if Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo and Impossible Things Happen Every Day belong to their respective songwriters. It's good that people who make things get to make money off their creations. I have my own personal artistic projects that I would like to earn money from and not have anybody else republish, reiterate, or rework without my permission or remuneration. This is not a bad thing. But the version of the public domain we have here in my country is deeply, deeply broken. In 1998, as a result of heavy lobbying from Disney, ironically enough, copyright laws in the United States were changed so that a work wouldn't enter the public domain for 95 years after its creation. This was done solely to keep Mickey Mouse from entering the public domain, and it's bad. It means that we have to pretend that an entire generation of works that are part of the public inheritance of story and music and words are off limits for republication, reiteration, and reworking. And The Wizard of Oz is one of its greatest victims. The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the novel by L. Frank Baum, was published in 1900, and its impact has been extraordinary. It is an American fairy tale. The United States has oral traditions in the forms of tall tales about Pecos Bill and Paul Bunyan, and of course, the deep layers of indigenous mythology and legends, tales of coyote and the terrible myth of the Wendigo. We have cryptids like Bigfoot and Mothman, and the jackalope. But our literary tradition of fairy tales is pretty small. We have Washington Irving's Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and we have The Wizard of Oz. The forms and places here are so American. Gray and Bear, Kansas, the Emerald City, which has always felt very much like the technological wonders of big cities like Chicago and New York. Deserts and forests and wide open spaces. It's a story of snake oil salesmen and grifters. We even have a tornado, a uniquely American disaster, and it has imprinted on the public's consciousness. Except, has it? Okay, picture our main crew. You have a scarecrow, a tin man, and a lion. There's a little dog and a girl. How old is she? Baum's novel describes a little girl. The math of later Oz books, yeah, there are more, a lot more, put her at about 11. But you are picturing a teenager, 16-year-old Judy Garland, aren't you? And now, I want you to picture the Wicked Witch of the West. What would you say was her defining physical characteristic? Her single eye that can see far distances like a telescope, right? No? Oh, you saw her as green, dressed all in black, with a pointed hat? Then you are not thinking of Baum's Wicked Witch, a crone with a golden cap that allows her to call upon the flying monkeys if she hops on one foot and says a charm. You are thinking of the 1939 movie. The green skin was added to take advantage of the wonders of Technicolor, the same reason the magic slippers were changed from Baum's silver to ruby. And it wasn't assumed from the get-go that she would look like this. Original concepts of the Wicked Witch had her looking a great deal like the Evil Queen from Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. The green was a choice. Now, there's been lots of pretending that the green doesn't belong to the 1939 movie. When Gregory Maguire first published the novel Wicked in 1995, he had to, for copyright reasons, insist that he was only basing his book on Baum's novel, which entered the public domain in 1954. And everybody just pretended he was telling the whole truth. Now, I would agree that Maguire's reworking of The Wizard of Oz is absolutely more in conversation with Baum's book than the 1939 movie. He's very interested in the different lands of Oz, their particular colors and cultures, and he's very interested in the political implications Baum set up, especially since Baum's later novels make it clear that the wizard is only in charge because he deposed a royal dynasty. But his witch is green. It's incredibly important to her character and the plot. And everybody has just decided to let all that slide. Now, when Stephen Schwartz and Winnie Holtzman adapted Wicked for the stage, they had to be a lot more careful when interacting with the 1939 musical, especially in its iconography. Glinda only wears pink once, during Dancing Through Life and Popular, which follows later that night. Everyone wears green glasses in the Emerald City, and the libretto implies that's the reason the city is green, as no one notices Elphaba's skin color. And the slippers are decidedly silver. Every reference to the 1939 movie in this show is a joke. Madame Morrible refers to something regarding Elphaba as a gulch. A punch is described as containing lemons and melons and pears, which is followed by, oh my. Elphaba, when asked by her sister why she dares return to a place where she is a wanted criminal, responds, "There's no place like home." Every one of these is a laugh line. The only sincere reference to the 1939 musical is an Easter egg hidden in the Unlimited theme. The first seven notes are the same as the beginning of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. The rhythm is different, as are the underlying chords. It's only seven notes because of copyright. Eight would be an infringement. And so, Wicked the Musical got away with Elphaba's green skin and became the most successful Wizard of Oz retelling since the 1939 film, even if new audience members continue to be confused by the silver slippers, pardon me, the jeweled slippers. And then John Chu made his film adaptation. In the opening shots of Wicked Part 1, the camera zooms along behind a flock of flying monkeys as the intense ostinatos of Schwartz's overture blares. And then, as the music shimmers out into the Unlimited theme, the camera zooms over a rainbow. Screw copyright! Somewhere Over the Rainbow belongs to us. By all rights, it should have entered the public domain 10 years ago, January 2015. If Disney hadn't broken copyright in 1998, it would be ours. Then we go to Munchkinland, surrounded by colored tulips, filled with people in whimsical colored outfits. In Baum's world, Munchkins dress in blue. Maguire retained this, as did the stage show. Shiz's colors are blue and white to match the Munchkins, but in Chu's film, they are colorful, and they run into town underscored by the opening notes of Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, ringing bells, shouting, come out, wherever you are, the opening words of that very song. Then, Glinda arrives in a bubble, exactly like she does in 1939, wearing a pale pink ball gown and a tall crown. Because the Wizard of Oz belongs to us. It shouldn't be the exclusive property of Warner Brothers, copyright claiming every ruby slipper and pink bubble. And every audience member who watches this movie knows that it isn't just a knockoff of Wizard of Oz. It's a retelling, a reworking, a reiteration. It isn't content to just dabble with public domain, off-brand, copyright-safe versions of Wizard of Oz. It's the version you have in your head, the one we've all inherited. This is a musical. Like that is a musical. This world is Art Nouveau by Art Deco, like that film. Somehow in 1900 and 1939 at the same time in fashion and imagination. And it's so good when the public domain gets to be the public domain. I felt it most when Elphaba and Glinda go to see the wizard. I have a deep sense memory of watching the 1939 movie as a kid, getting very uncomfortable when Dorothy and her friends walk down that claustrophobic rounded hallway. In my mind, that hallway lasts forever. The atmosphere has shifted from delight to dread. In the stage show of Wicked, the focus is on the Oz head, a prop more silly than intimidating. And while Elphaba and Glinda are scared, we aren't. We know what that is. The stage show wants us happy. It's still very much luring us into happy thoughts. In Chu's film, the palace again becomes an Art Deco nightmare. Elphaba and Glinda must walk past a legion of monkeys, stoic and intimidating. The rounded hallway is dark and sinister and filled with dread. It put me right back in that place of watching the 1939 movie. Pure discomfort. And the flying monkeys themselves. In the stage show, they're a reference, an afterthought. John Chu gives us a flying monkey jump scare, allowing them to be as terrifying as the 1939 monkeys are in our collective imagination. Now, I want to make a distinction. We live in a media ecosystem filled with reboots, remakes, and regurgitative sequels. We're used to seeing the same story told to us over and over again, held together by references and iconography. Every studio is squeezing money out of each piece of intellectual property they've scrambled over. Jurassic Park gets a new movie this summer, complete with repetitions of famous lines and returned raptors. This is after they already squeezed out a messy and shallow trilogy, finishing up with soulless reappearances from its original stars. This year, we also get a near shot-for-shot remake of How to Train Your Dragon, only with fewer colors, terrible green screen, horrible acting, and a toothless, improved by next-generation PlayStation graphics. It's easy to say references are cheap and lazy. They often are. It's easy to say originality is where true art lies. That's only partially true. All art is built on the art that comes before it. And good art is often in overt conversation and dialogue with what has come before. The Wonderful Wizard of Oz gets a lot of credit for its weirdness, its fascinating, interesting, bizarre world. But that ignores the fact that it is in conversation with Alice in Wonderland, itself in conversation with Mother Goose. Did you forget that the Queen of Hearts is a nursery rhyme? Oh! And who compiled Mother Goose? Why, our old friend Charles Perrault, who collected folktales and sayings and put his own spin on it. Yes, he gave us the most identifiable Cinderella, but that's a story far older than him, tracing initial roots back to both Egypt and China. There are academics who have boiled down stories to their separate components, arguing there are really only 7 plots. But of course, that isn't our experience of them. Every good story is changed by its teller, and in its differences we see meaning. Baum took Lewis Carroll's Wonderland and gave it a distinct structure with unique peoples run by specific politics. Both books held satire for their separate societies. Carroll critiqued the absurdism of Victorian England's rigidly articulated roles and systems. Baum critiqued the quackery and scams of American myth-making, the way we let leaders build stories of themselves. Gregory Maguire took Baum's book into adult realities of corrupted systems, of religion and government and systems of oppression. Schwartz and Holtzman softened those realities to explore how change really happens, the importance of soft power alongside heartfelt identification with the oppressed. And yes, John Chu is just retelling the story Schwartz and Holtzman broke. Except, he has this ingrained filmic language of the 1939 Wizard of Oz, these assumptions held by his audience. So he uses them to lead his audience on a journey, to point them to jarring differences. We see a pointed black hat in a puddle of water. We see flying monkeys. We go over the rainbow. There's the yellow brick road and a teenage Dorothy. There's an Art Deco Emerald City. Here's a colorful munchkin land and a pink Glinda in her bubble while we sing about a dead witch. So why does this feel uncomfortable? They're so angry. But the music is happy, aggressive in its happiness. The new elements stand out. There's this creeping sense that maybe Glinda isn't actually a good guy. There's tragic backstory for our baby witch. The differences shake the audience, make them question the assumptions we want them to focus on. Not, why are the munchkins blue? But, why are they cruel? Not, why is Glinda in an ordinary white suit? But, oh gosh, she's not very nice. Oh gosh, she's never been very nice. I think if Warner Brothers, who owns the film rights to the 1939 film, if they had made Wicked, the similarities would have been merely superficial, merely there to make this movie as marketable as possible. And while Wicked did rely heavily on recognizable imagery in its marketing, it seems very clear that John Chu isn't merely regurgitating that imagery for easy consumption. He's adding context and layers of storytelling, reframing the familiar in an interesting and engaging way. He isn't taking the stage choreography and placing it in a school courtyard edited together with different cuts. He is using that which should be in the public domain, the film language of one of the most influential movie musicals of all time, to tell us a new story, one that has resonated beyond the confines of theater kid audiences, over the rainbow, to the whole varied spectrum of the film-going public. Thanks for coming.